It's the mostly unspoken agreement between lighthouses and their keepers, an agreement that the humans will stay out there for weeks in seas that show no shame or any great effort in spawning huge tower blocks of waves. Waves that rise up and scratch at the lighthouse as though it were an itchy spot. And the keepers stayed put out there in all that because of the agreement. The lighthouse's part of the deal, of course, was to do nothing, go nowhere, be as permanent as the rocks they're fastened to. If you should talk to any former keeper, they'll undoubtedly tell you about some night, some day, some fortnight, at the bad time of year, when the weather got stuck, and the keeper sat inside the lighthouse listening, swaddled in walls every bit as stout as they needed to be, sure that whatever thunder he hears, no matter what pounding on the walls, this thing will pass, he says. And you know, mostly, he's right. Mostly. Which is why the story of the Calf Rock has a certain piquancy for every keeper. A lighthouse was finished on the rock in 1864 and set to welcome ships and weather coming in from America. It was a cast-iron lighthouse made by Henry Grizzle, whose company had already produced similar high-tech marvels for use in the West Indies and Russia. And for many years it put up with whatever the Atlantic threw at it, suffering only what, for a lighthouse, amounted to cuts and bruises. But then came a night at the end of November in 1881, when the sea rose to some new height and the lighthouse broke its contract. The structure, which had been brought in sheets from Grizzle's Hoxton ironworks and bolted together on the rock, was sheared from its base, snapped off like a pencil top by waves for which the word freak seems way too mild. Waves freakish enough to send the whole structure, with its precious oil lantern spilling best spermaceti as they tumbled downwards towards the sea. Today, that stretch of water is marked by beams from a lighthouse built on the Calf's neighbour, the Bull, a little higher above sea level, high enough to see what's left of the Calf's lighthouse. A beautiful nub of iron, an amputee's wound, and a graphic orange flourish, reading for anyone with the code, Danger at Sea. In this week's Lighthouse Stories, we're calling Mayday, Mayday, logging some of the occasions when lighthouse keepers have confronted that dangerous sea, making life-saving dashes along the way. Gerald Butler was a lighthouse keeper at the Fastnet during the tragic yacht race of 1979.
I remember there was a woman called Mrs. Good. She rang me to know, could you come out to sit under the rock and look at the yacht surrounding, and I said, you know, I think you shouldn't do this. I said, we are not happy with the way things are going. We think it's going to get bad. So she didn't come out anyway. But the storm turned out to be absolutely frighteningly horrendous. Even underneath the Fastnet, the yachts there were getting such a hammering. When a wave would hit the tower, it would just leave the lantern sticking out on the top. Standing on the balcony, everything beneath our feet was obscured. You just see this violent flat platform of water violently rushing horizontally across beneath our feet. And when it fell down, when it totally collapsed, it came down on top of the yachts that were close to the rock, trying to round it from the east. And we had an Aldous lamp that we shone on the sail numbers, and we could see them below when the water would fall all around them, and they were just in a massive surge of white water all around them. They were up to their knees on top of the decks. The boat would be driven down that hard by the broken waves. All along the coast then, we were listening to the distress frequency, and you'd hear yachts being capsized, more yachts just upside down, no sign of life on them, more yachts just drifting by and nothing happening, no communication of any sort, crews gone, missing from them. And that continued all during the night. That storm, as I say, it wasn't predicted. It popped up out of the blue and it just wreaked havoc. It was so unfortunate that there were 3,000 people on top of the water that night from Land's End to Fastnet.
The race began on the 11th of August at Cowes on the Isle of Wight before a drastic and unexpected change of weather on Monday, August 13th.
From 11, 12 o'clock onwards that day, we would have prepared our dinner and the balcony door was open and we were in and out constantly watching to see what time the first of the yachts were coming. The wind was with the yachts. In other words, the wind was blowing in the same direction that the yachts were coming. But nonetheless, the sea was still flat calm. They came, sailed around the rock. I remember looking out and thinking, gosh, these things are absolutely colossal.
Ted Crosby of the Irish Examiner was on the sea that evening. He'd enjoyed a family fastnet tradition with his father, Tom, sailing to the lighthouse with photographers on board to take pictures of the boats as they raced by. In the years following his father's death, Ted kept up the family vigil at Fastnet as skipper of the yacht, Mariquita.
And then in 79, I had bought my new boat and I decided to do it on my own. And I took two daughters, a crew, Finbar Butler, who has been racing with me since 1974, and a somewhat reluctant photographer called Mike Lolney, who was a very good photographer but not a great sailor. And my memory of it was, we went out and the sea was as flat as a board. We photographed the first big one about 3 o'clock. Going around the fastener. She was so big, she was way ahead of everything. And then from about 6 o'clock in the evening, the sky darkened. The sea stayed very smooth, but the rocks around the fastener got very fretful. And you could see, get the odd wave off the keepers, and the fastener lighthouse and the rock got darker and darker.
The wind shifted back to south-southeast and it increased to 4-6. 4-6 now is quite ugly on the water. It's not a storm warning, but it's a danger warning for small vessels. And at that time, I noticed a small vessel had come out around the fastnet from the Crookhaven side. That was when I first saw it. And it was a beautiful hull, brand new vessel, but also the wind was increasing and it was no place for a small boat to be. I then put my binoculars to my head and kept watching that boat for about 4 hours non-stop, simply because the conditions were deteriorating rapidly.
Was Ted Crosby's Mariquita the boat that Gerald saw? Impossible to know. We just know that Ted's boat was off the fastnet at one point and that Gerald also became concerned for the safety of a pleasure craft that evening. We know that one man experienced the fastnet storm at sea level and the other from a lighthouse balcony. And in that way, at least, their stories are intertwined.
So there we are. We didn't have a radio. We didn't have any forecast. But it was quite obvious that something was going to happen. The next vessel that came up was Ted Turner in a boat called the Tenacious. Now, Ted Turner was a famous character in America in the media business. And we photographed him at about 7:30. He was roaring like a bull and they pulled in all the sails, got around the fastener, and you could see the bad weather, but the sea was still flat as a board at the fastnet. But if you look at any of the photographs taken by Michael Olney, it's his angry and fretful, if flat. So I said to the crew, we're heading for home, I don't like the look of it. And from about 4, 5, 6 at the fastest, at half past 7, it was blowing force 9 or 10 by the time we got to Skull an hour later.
At 8 p.m, the wind increased to gale force 8, and it also started to rain at that time. Now, I had been watching that little boat all the time in my binoculars. The rain didn't hamper or impede my vision. I was still able to see it through the binoculars out on the balcony.
So in we go to Skull, full of good intentions that Michael Olney would be landed at the pier and the pictures would appear in the Examiner on the Tuesday morning. But there was no getting into the pier. So what could we do? We went out. We put down 2 anchors, a main one on a heavy rope and a kedge anchor. And we lay to over an ever-rising storm and a big southeasterly sea coming in. And there my two daughters, Suzanne and Elizabeth, cooked us a nice dinner until about 10:30, when it was really piping up. And the 2 anchors dragged together. So we had obviously no opportunity of re-anchoring. So we pulled up the main one. And of course, silly ass of a helmsman, me, got the cage rope around the propeller and that put the engine out of action. So we hoisted the mainsail, put 3 reefs in it, and took off out. Now, anyone who knows Skull knows Long Island and Long Island Sound, which runs in an east-west direction. The reason we went for Long Island Sound was that the Skull is wide open to the south-southeast wind, and you were getting almost hurricane conditions into Skull. We used the shelter of Long Island and the smooth water of the Sound between that and the mainland as our track for the night. It meant that we stayed in the same position in the Sound for 5 hours.
The lights of that small boat disappeared. The wind was still blowing very, very hard up to Gale Force 8, and I became alarmed because I had lost the mast headlights of that boat. So I decided to come in and call the lifeboat. I felt much safer when the lifeboat was out around looking for that fella. But when I made the call, I found out that the lifeboat was already launched. It was already at sea. It was already searching for this boat. And that was of great comfort.
Gerald and his fellow keepers, Reggie Sugru and Louis Cronin, saw the main fleet of racing yachts arrive amid ever-worsening conditions.
I know when it was dark at 10 o'clock, there was quite a lot of yachts coming from the east. All you would see is the mast headlights, and quite a lot of them, like little fairy lights, all moving to and fro with the yacht pitching and tossing. After midnight, the number of yachts weren't as many as we would have expected. I hadn't realised at that stage the amount of yachts that had abandoned. When the main fleet of the yachts arrived, we used the Aldus lamp, reading their sail numbers as they rounded the rock. Then we radioed that information straight into the mizzen. They would telephone that off to Cowes and the Isle of Wight, and also to the Cork Examiner. When we shone that light, we were able to see the crew members and the amount of work they were having to do just to keep their yachts on course, to keep them trimmed up. We knew we weren't able to talk to the yachts. We knew nobody else was either, because VHF radio was in its infancy and nobody had it. So we knew that there was going to be a lot of disaster and a lot of tragedy happening. They'd lose the wind from the sail when they'd go down into a trough, and then a wave would hit the yacht high up and fill the sails with water, and that would turn the yacht right over on its side, and in some cases the yacht would continue right upside down. The crew members were attached by a safety lanyard to the yacht. Some of these were thrown clear into the water. And as the yacht would upright itself again, they were dragged underneath the yacht and back up on the far side again. And they would be pulled back in or pull themselves back in. This is where the tragedy started to happen. Some of these harnesses opened or the lines opened. And once a sailor was dislodged from the yacht, he was gone. He was drifting off in a different direction.
When the lifeboat failed to find the missing pleasure craft, it responded to another mayday.
At 1:35 a.m. in the morning, the yacht Regardless, they put off a distress call, a mayday call, because they had lost their rudder. The lifeboat, the Robert, was at sea, still searching for that little vessel that I had called it out for. So once the Regardless put off a mayday, they then came to the assistance, put a line on board and towed the yacht into Baltimore. They lost the line about five times. So it was a very difficult manoeuvre to get the yacht into Baltimore. At 3 o'clock, when the wind shifted in towards the west, it was enough to hoist the sea right up over the lighthouse. Now, under the balcony, the tower is flared out like the bow of a ship to throw the sea clear of the lantern, to keep it clear of the glazing on top, to protect the light. And it was now doing its job full belt, because every wave was crashing very, very hard against the tower.
Our period reaching up and down Long Island Sound lasted from 12 o'clock until 4 o'clock. And to this day, Mariquita and her crew are known as the ghosts of Long Island Sound. Even in 2014, when I was in Skulnately, oh, there's the ghosts, to see. That was all right. The wind went west and then went northwest, and we came in and we anchored off Skull Pier. What I didn't realise at the time is that the keepers of the Fasted Light had contacted Baltimore Lifeboat about a brown yacht that had been there all day and had disappeared, and they had, should have a look for it. And it's been on my conscience ever since that because I was still paying for Mariquita, I hadn't put in an expensive VHF into her. And I have apologised to Baltimore on frequent occasions every time I meet them over that, because there was other work they should have been doing instead of looking for me, the ghost.
In the early hours of August 14th and the days that followed, the tragic aftermath of the storm became apparent, but also the place of the lighthouse at the centre of the tempest.
There was a fair share of wreckage around, and the rescue of the competitors and various other boats was an immaculate example of Irish-English cooperation of the rescue services and indeed the defence forces. I think probably the great contribution to the whole event was the fact that people could concentrate on the Fastnet, that they knew roughly where they would be. And I think that the credit goes to the keepers reporting, signifying to the rescue services anything that was within 20 miles of their radius. And I think in fairness to Irish Lights and the keepers, if there's something like the Fastnet race going on, they put keepers onto the rock. I won't talk too much about computer technology, but that could put up signals as well. But I think the human eye and the human brain and the human sympathy is probably slightly more effective.
It wasn't until maybe a day or 2 days later that we heard the amount of people that were lost. There were 15 yachtsmen, 15 competitors lost. And there was also 3 more lost off another yacht that was shadowing the race. They too would have been in the exact same difficulty as everybody else. And Mrs. Good rang back to the Fastnet. She was so thankful, so appreciative of the warning she had been given, and so delighted that she heeded that warning and did not come out to the Fastnet. And I say, from our own point of view then, it made me feel somewhat of a success, if that's the right word to use, in that I had inadvertently, you could say, saved somebody, in that just by warning them, you know. I was delighted with that. Yeah.
40 years before, the lighthouse keepers of Skellig Michael faced an almost impossible emergency in dense fog. Author and boatman Des Lavelle remembers the story when his father was a lighthouse keeper on Skellig.
Of course, lighthouses today are not what they used to be. We miss the lighthouse men because their help and their advice was always invaluable. Okay, the light still shines and the light still gives a message, for the moment at least. But it has its limitations. When the fog is down, the lighthouse is no good. Indeed, there's a story about that. Way back when my father was here, one of the lighthouse men took ill. It was a foggy weather. Now, the normal communication then was semaphore signals to the Bull Rock, which is the next lighthouse, maybe 18 miles south of here, and they would relay the message into the shore to say there was something wrong or whatever the problem was. But of course, the fog was intervening. The Bull Rock, they couldn't see the Bull Rock. They couldn't send the message, and one of the men was quite ill and needed some kind of assistance. Now, the next resort is to flares, distress flares, and they fired all the distress flares, and still nobody saw the distress flares, and one of the lighthouse men needed medical attention seriously. How do you get help in this situation? Well, my father was here that time. It was about 1933, maybe. And he carted every kind of fuel he could find up to the monastery, which is some 600 feet up on the cliff, or bits of rags, oily rags. They had plenty of oil, of course, because it was an oil-operated light at that time. Bits of boxes, everything they could find, and built a great bonfire up on top. Such a bonfire that glowed in the fog, that was seen on the mainland. And finally, men from Port McGee came out to see what was going on, and they brought the ill man ashore. So, yes, lighthouse communication is one thing, but you've got to have the means to make the communication in the first place. And that was 1933. Things have improved since that.
And did your father ever tell you that he'd met any of the many ghosts that seemed to be frequenting
the lighthouse? I often asked him in later years, you know, that very question. And his answer was, I never saw anything worse than myself. I'd say a lot of lighthouse men would probably agree with that. But there are stories, yes, about somebody almost pushed over the cliff. And, stories are good. You can add to them or you can subtract to make up your own happy ending or otherwise.
Thanks to the bravery and altruism of the lighthouse keepers, the lifeboats and tenacious sailors like Ted Crosby, not everybody's emergency has ended in tragedy. As the occupation of the keeper passes into history, we have all the more reason to remember a unique way of life and life-saving whenever the next storm moves in.